follicular phase, the mucus is thick, indicating infertility. And you can see that in the lower graph of the cervix and mucus. As estrogen rises before ovulation, mucus becomes thinner and more watery. Some women may not actually observe it, but they may certainly feel the sensation and oftentimes will note that. The fertile cervical mucus is only present for a few days of the cycle as the estrogen rises, leading to ovulation when the egg is released. Again, both the fertile cervical mucus and egg are necessary for conception to occur. So a couple is really only fertile for a few days each cycle, and studies have shown that that length of time is 6 days long. After ovulation, as estrogen levels fall and progesterone level rises, progesterone causes the mucus to become thick and impermeable, acting like a plug and barrier to sperm. This is also how artificial methods of contraception that are progesterone-only work. They basically create a thick barrier to prevent sperm penetration. With the rise in progesterone, you also get a rise in the basal body temperature. Again, this is an external sign that a woman can observe. So what's so wonderful about this is that women can use these external observations to learn all she needs to know about what's happening internally with her hormones, and use this information to identify naturally her periods of fertility and infertility within her cycle. Again, as I said, these methods are based on science that's been going on for more than half a century now. Beginning in the 1950s, Dr. Cohen described cervical mucus around the time of ovulation, and he published a schemata of its physical characteristics. Bimbarket, which is basically describes the ability of mucus to spin into a thread, the viscosity, quantity, and presence of leukocytes. Most importantly, Dr. Cohen found that mucus type correlates to sperm survival, so he called this a biological valve. When mucus was thin and stretchy with low leukocytes, type E mucus, sperm survival was very high and allows for sperm penetration. Meanwhile, from 1959 to 1963, Professor Eric Odeblad microsampled cervical crypts and described several different types of cervical mucus, including the type E mucus, which he further delineated into types P, S, and L. Types P, S, and L all influence the survival of sperm. L mucus is designed to help pick out imperfect sperm and prevent them from fertilizing the ovum. S mucus brings sperm into the crypts of the cervix and keeps them alive and healthy there. And P mucus allows the sperm to enter into the uterus and into the fallopian tubes where fertilization can occur. As you can see on the left side of this graph, the type E mucus forms channels. These channels, again, help sperm move into the uterine cavity where they'll reach the fallopian tube and fertilization can occur. Since this mucus functions to help sperm reach the ovum, it is only present at certain times of peak fertility leading up to ovulation. Contrast this to the type G mucus on the right, which lacks these channels. As you can see, type G mucus creates an impermeable barrier that prevents the sperm from entering the cervix. This is secreted during the luteal phase under the influence of progesterone. The three components of fertility define an actual fertile window each cycle during which a woman can become pregnant, and we can identify it each cycle. Scientists have studied the probability of pregnancy from intercourse on days relative from ovulation, and this graph here comes from an article published in the New England Journal of Medicine. What they discovered using ultrasound and hormonal studies is that women are only fertile for a 6-day period. These are the 5 days leading up to ovulation, during which cervical mucus allows sperm to survive within a woman's genital tract, and 1 day following ovulation, the length of time that the egg can survive. Again, sperm can live in the fertile mucus for up to 5 days, and fertilization can occur up to 24 hours post-ovulation. So this gives us a total of 6 days. That being said, however, the highest probability of pregnancy, between 25 to 28% of pregnancies, occur 2 days before ovulation. By 1 day after ovulation, the probability of pregnancy drops to zero. So this begs the question, if women are only fertile for 6 days out of the month, is it just for us as physicians to be prescribing them a medication that they're taking every single day, exposing them to the unnecessary side effects when there are other more effective ways in which they can learn to understand and manage their fertility? So in summary, mucus and ovulation together define the fertile window. And how do we recognize it? The same hormones that control ovulation also modulate the observable signs of fertility. If a couple can identify the fertile window, they may use that for family planning. At the beginning of the cycle, a developing follicle secretes the estrogen. This causes the cervix to produce the clear, stretchy egg white mucus that you can see on the right. This is a sign of fertility because it allows sperm to live in the cervix awaiting the ovum, and this is a sign clearly visible to the woman. With the spike in LH, this causes the follicle to burst and release the ovum, ovulation. When this happens, some women will observe or experience sharp lower abdominal pains, often referred to as middle schmerz. However, not all women will notice this. Once the ruptured follicle becomes the corpus luteum, again, it secretes progesterone internally to maintain the uterine lining, and mucus dries up. And this, again, indicates the closing of the fertile window. With this rise in progesterone, women will be able to observe not only the change in her cervical mucus, but a rise in basal body temperature. And finally, as the corpus luteum atrophies and the progesterone secretion stops, the uterine lining sheds, and women can quite easily observe their menstrual flow. Hopefully, at this point, you have a good understanding of the scientific basis behind these methods. I'll pause here, John, if there are any questions before I go into a discussion of the different types of fertility awareness-based methods of family planning.
No questions as of yet. And again, if you have any questions for Dr. Duane, you'd like to submit those, that's available on our webcast online on our website. Submit the question on the box.
Wonderful.
And push it. Thank you.
Well, hopefully that was very clear and you all understand the science behind it. And hopefully you realize it's not very complicated. This is something that we can easily teach patients, although not to that level of detail necessarily. But now that you understand the physiology and the relevant research, let's talk about how this translates into actual methods of family planning. Before we go into the different types, though, let's talk about how you evaluate evidence for effectiveness. It's important to understand how to determine the strength of evidence because people will often challenge you if you discuss natural methods of family planning saying that they're not effective. But the research has been done, and it's important that you be able to identify the effective research that's out there. Primary care researchers and journals have developed what's called the SORT taxonomy, or strength of recommendation taxonomy. They use this to assess the quality and consistency of available evidence published in research studies. To do this, you first assess the quality of evidence in the study. A level 1 or level 2 study has patient-oriented outcomes rather than disease-oriented outcomes. Disease-oriented outcomes do not necessarily translate into patient-oriented outcomes. A good example of this is in the treatment of diabetes, as an example. You may give a patient a medication that lowers their blood sugar, and while that may be a good disease-oriented outcome, if it causes a patient to pass out and have other problems, it's not necessarily a patient-oriented outcome. Along the lines with natural methods of family planning, if you're evaluating them for effectiveness in achieving live birth, if methods only help women conceive and get pregnant but not actually have a child because there may be recurrent miscarriage, it's not a patient-oriented outcome. So we look at results that matter to patients. Level 1 and Level 2 studies also differ in study quality. For example, prospective cohort studies with good follow-up would reach a Level 1 quality study. A retrospective study or prospective studies with poor follow-up are Level 2. The second thing that needs to be assessed in terms of looking at the evaluation, in terms of evaluating the quality of evidence, is the consistency of the evidence. That is, do multiple studies find similar findings? If you've got two or three studies that find widely different things, those would be considered inconsistent. Based on the quality and consistency of the research, the strength of recommendation for a body of evidence is determined. And it's graded. And for those of you that are in medicine or medical students or residents and you read journals, you'll often see these grades referring to studies. So an A recommendation signifies that there's good quality patient-oriented evidence shown in multiple studies. A B recommendation signifies there is evidence of limited quality or findings are inconsistent across studies. A B recommendation is also assigned if there is good quality patient-oriented evidence from only one study, as is the case with some of the NFP methods. A C recommendation signifies the evidence is disease-oriented or is based on consensus, a bunch of experts, so-called experts getting together and saying that this is a good idea, rather than based on well-conducted research trials. This evening, all of the evidence that I will be presenting to you for each of the different methods are level A or level B evidence. And again, this is important to be able to share this with those that might question the effectiveness. I should note that the FACTS group does have a review article that will be published in the Osteopathic Family Physician Journal that does go through all of this and the different methods and the evidence supporting it. So I would encourage you to certainly be on the lookout for that within the next year. There was just an article published in the American Family Physician on natural family planning that, while it is a good article, does not actually look in great detail at the level of evidence for each of these methods. But together, those two articles should be something you keep in your resource library, and hopefully Med Students for Life can keep it on their website for you to refer back to in the future. So, what I'd like to do now is talk about cervical mucus methods, because these only rely on observing cervical secretions. These methods are also sometimes called ovulation methods because most of them will indicate when a woman is ovulating. We're going to discuss three main types of cervical mucus methods: the Billings ovulation method, the Creighton model, and the two-day method. Again, all are based on noting the presence or absence of cervical secretions. Remember that clear, wet, slippery, or lubricous secretions indicate days of fertility. Different methods require a different level of detail regarding the observations and recording of them. Some of these will identify the fertile window, including both the Billings and Creighton method, so they can be used to achieve or avoid pregnancy. As you can see from the unintended pregnancy rates listed below, this simple sign all women can identify is extremely reliable. With correct use, the pregnancy rate is about 96 to 99% effective. That is less than 0.14 to 3.5 pregnancies per 100 women years. With typical use, it's comparable to other user-directed methods, such as a condom or the pill, for purposes of avoiding pregnancy. And again, the evidence for these studies are of level A and B quality. Let me talk about the methods themselves. The Billings method was first developed in the early 1960s by Dr. John and Evelyn Billings. It's the first cervical mucus method and the first modern fertility awareness-based method of family planning developed. Essentially, what women do throughout the day is to tune into the sensation of mucus at the vulva. They can also take a more detailed observation, such as looking at the mucus on toilet tissue, but they do not have to do so. Because a woman is able to sense as little as 5 milligrams of mucus at the vulva, while it requires 40 milligrams to be able to pick up a sample, sensation is actually a very sensitive parameter. They will then note on a chart if mucus is present and describe its qualities, color, stretchiness, or sensations in their own words. The diagram at the bottom hopefully helps show these examples. This is an example of a Billings chart for one cycle, and here's how it works. A woman notes her cervical secretions and represents them with either a stamp or a symbol. As you can see, I've shown both. So, for example, on day 1 through 3, she uses red stamps and a circle under the symbol category to indicate that she has her menses. She also will note the sensation that she has at the vulva and anything else that she considers important. So, again, as you can see, she's written in her own words on the bottom line what she's observed. After menses, when estrogen is low, she will probably feel dryness at the vulva. As estrogen levels rise, her cervical secretions will change, usually from dry to sticky, as you can see on day 9 and 10. This indicates that her fertile window is opening. The secretions will become stringy, slippery, and clear as a woman approaches her peak day, which correlates closely with ovulation. Peak day is the last day that mucus looks either slippery, clear, or stretchy. As you can see here, it's day 15. Because on day 16, the mucus changes from, again, slippery and clear to dry on day 16, and this is due to the influence of elevated progesterone. The fertile window closes on the third day after peak. And typically with both the Billings and the Creighton method, although ovulation is thought to occur on peak day, it is actually known to occur Research shows that ovulation occurs 98% of the time by peak plus 3. Typically, it occurs between a couple days prior to peak up to a couple days after peak. So by defining 3 days after the peak day as fertile days, you increase the reliability of this method to help avoid pregnancy. The most advanced cervical mucus method is the Creighton model. As with Billings, the user characterizes and records the presence and quality of cervical mucus. However, the Creighton model uses a standardized and systematic approach to these observations that women are taught to remember using the acronym SOCT. S stands for sensation at the vulva, which a woman is taught to observe. O is for observation of cervical mucus on tissue. And FT stands for actually finger testing the mucus quality to evaluate stretchiness, color, etc. There's also a very specific methodology and vocabulary for recording these observations. Like Billings, the Creighton model also identifies a peak day. The last day of peak-type mucus, again, is stretchy, clear, or lubricative. This is generally considered the day of highest fertility as it's right around ovulation. Creighton is more involved and requires more training for both the instructor and couple to learn. However, its universal and standard recording system allows a health provider to know exactly what symptoms women are describing. Some patterns of mucus are very reliable signs of pathology. This allows physicians who are trained as Creighton medical consultants to use a newly developed technology called Natural Procreative Technology, or NAPRO technology, to medically evaluate, diagnose, and treat gynecological health problems such as infertility, endometriosis, PCOS, and others. Here is a sample Creighton chart. The user marks her menses with red stamps, dry days with green stamps, and the mucus days up to peak day in white. The 3 days, potentially fertile days after peak, are, as you can see here, are marked with light green. As she charts, a woman can use this to determine her fertility on a day-to-day basis. This particular slide also shows the correlation with blood tests for estradiol in black and progesterone in gray that were drawn on this particular patient in this particular cycle. As we've discussed, the externally observable signs correlate well with the biochemical processes. So as you can see the estradiol rising, as you see the elevation of the black bars, you can see the mucus changing from green to the white baby stamps. Then as progesterone rises, you can see it moving from white into the green, representing the dry days. The two-day method is the simplest cervical method. This was developed by Georgetown's Institute for Reproductive Health as part of its global effort to mainstream natural methods of family planning and bring them to large public health programs. The user checks each day to see if she has cervical secretions or not. That's it. She doesn't have to observe the quantity or the quality of mucus. If she sees mucus, she simply notes it. This means a provider can easily teach the two-day method in a single 20-minute office visit, no matter what the patient's education level is, using teaching aids developed by the Institute for Reproductive Health. Since the two-day method doesn't identify a fertile window, it's less informative than Creighton or Billings. However, it's still a very accurate way to identify potential days of fertility. Excuse me. This illustration shows a woman how to use the two-day method. Essentially, she asks herself two questions every day. First, did I note secretions today? And second, did I note secretions yesterday? If she noted secretions of any type today or yesterday, she should consider herself potentially fertile and has a chance of getting pregnant if she has sex today, hence the name two-day. However, if she did not note any secretions today or yesterday, she's unlikely to become pregnant if she has sex today. And then the next day, she repeats the same questions. Now, while this method is very simple and easy to teach, it does have the disadvantage in that it cannot be used in women that may have a chronic vaginal discharge because that would make it more difficult. So that's an overview of the cervical mucus method. I'll pause here, John, if there are any questions before I move on to the single thermal method. Okay, if not, let's let's talk about methods that combine cervical mucus observations with at least one other sign. These are the symptothermal or symptohormonal methods. Common symptothermal methods are couple-to-couple league, Northwest, and Serena. The best-known symptohormonal method is the Marquette model, of which there are different types. All these methods have one thing in common. They use cervical mucus observations, but also have the user check for another marker of fertility as a cross-check to more clearly define the fertile window. A woman notes these markers on a chart and can find the fertile window in the infertile times in her cycle. Because these methods identify a fertile window, they can also be used to both achieve or avoid pregnancy. Again, as you can see, these cross-check methods are comparable to hormonal contraceptives at preventing pregnancy. With correct use rate, there's up to 2 pregnancies per 100 woman years, and with typical use, depending on which method, symptothermal has been found to be much more effective with 1.6 pregnancies per 100 years, whereas Marquette has been found to have typical use rates of 14 pregnancies per 100 woman years. Part of why that may be with the Marquette methods, it actually defines a more narrow fertile window. So let's talk a little bit more in detail about the symptothermal method. The symptothermal method combines cervical mucus to identify the beginning of the fertile window and basal body temperature to find the end of the fertile window. Remember, when progesterone rises after ovulation, basal body temperature increases notably and reliably. Basal body temperature helps clarify mucus observations and show that ovulation has indeed occurred. If she likes, a woman using symptothermal can also add other observations, such as the position and softness of the cervix or calendar calculations based on her previous cycle. However, these other signs have not undergone the same amount of rigorous testing as mucus and basal body temperature, so they're strictly secondary observations. Cross-checking 2 studied symptoms of fertility should give couples more confidence in their prediction of when they're fertile and when they're not. Here is what a typical menstrual cycle looks like on a symptothermal chart. The user will record her cervical mucus observations, both sensation and characteristics, at the bottom of the chart each day, using the most fertile reading of the day. She marks the level of fertility that it indicates. She also will take her basal body temperature with a specific thermometer at the same time each day before getting out of bed and record it on the graph. As you can see in phase 1, mucus readings are generally dry and the basal body temperature is lower than at the end of the cycle. However, what matters is not the actual temperature itself, but the change in temperature. So in the beginning, the mucus observations are important to help identify the start of the fertile window. When mucus that feels moist or slippery and stretchy shows that peak 1 has ended, and phase 2, or the fertile period, has begun. Basal body temperature is mostly a retroactive indicator because temperature peaks after ovulation. When temperature has been elevated for 3 days and peak day indicated by mucus changes has passed, the fertile window has closed and phase 3 has begun. A woman can be confident at that point that she is no longer fertile. And as I've told patients, they can have sex every day, 10 times a day, and they will not conceive. Because once the egg has died, it's impossible for a woman to become pregnant until her next cycle. If a woman does use this method to become pregnant, the user can observe her plot and know which day she ovulated and identify the estimated date of conception. This can be very important later in obstetrical management, and it's a much more accurate indicator of gestational age than the last menstrual period, which is commonly used. Again, as you can see in the last line on this chart, cervical observations are recorded, but these are optional. You will note that the cervix softens and opens as estrogen rises, as you can see in phase 2, often changing a couple days before the changes in cervical mucus. Palpating the cervix allows a woman to observe early indicators of approaching fertility. Charting can be done either on paper charts or online through couple-to-couple league. Symptohormonal, or Marquette method. Let's talk about this next. With the Marquette model, women use a handheld battery-operated device, the Clear Blue Easy Fertility Monitor, to measure estrogen metabolite and luteinizing hormone, or LH, levels. The monitor indicates the level of fertility that day by reading test sticks for the amount of estrogen metabolite and LH in the urine. These observations are secondary to cervical mucus observations, the other sign in this cross-check method. The monitor can also track other signs of fertility, such as basal body temperature, as we discussed just prior. Further, the user can teach herself to use this method online and track her daily observations online, too. Here's an example of the online charting system using the Marquette method. It asks for user input about mucus levels and descriptions, as well as the reading from the fertility monitor. The monitor provides three levels of fertility, low, high, and peak, as does the mucus. High fertility begins when the monitor detects rising levels of estrogen metabolites in the urine and as the mucus becomes thin and watery. Peak fertility begins when the monitor detects the surge in luteinizing hormone right before ovulation and when the mucus becomes slippery. The fertile window closes when estrogen is low and the mucus is thickened. At this point, I'm going to talk about a modern and reliable calendar method of fertility awareness-based methods of family planning. The standard days method. The standard days method was also developed by the Georgetown Institute for Reproductive Health, and it's a simple fertility awareness-based method that uses a standardized algorithm to determine the possible fertile days in women with regular cycles. It identifies the same fertile days for every woman. These days are identified based on an understanding of the fertile period in women with cycles 26 to 32 days. While this might sound like a narrow range, about 75% of women have cycles that are 26 to 32 days in length, and 75 to 90% of all cycles are 26 to 32 days in length. So it's really suitable for a great majority of women. With this method, with women who have cycles between 26 to 32 days in length, women consider days 8 through 19 as the fertile window. This starts early enough for women who might have a short cycle and lasts long enough for those with long cycles. The World Health Organization considers this a modern method because this was actually developed using research studies of women using this method. It follows a precise protocol for correct use and has been extensively tested in appropriately designed research studies. The research has shown that with correct use, the pregnancy rate is less than 5 per 100 women years, and with typical use, it's about 12 per 100 women years. This is more effective than barrier methods such as the condom or the diaphragm in terms of preventing pregnancy with typical use. Of note, it's important to note that these efficacy rates do include participants who had up to two cycles out of the range of the 26 to 32 days. So even with women that may have a cycle out of the range, these are still pretty effective methods. Here's an example of the cycle beads used for women to track her cycle with the standard days method. Do you see the black rubber ring on the brown bead up at about 2 o'clock? On the first day of menstruation, the woman places this ring on the red bead, and then she moves it forward each day in the direction in a clockwise direction. The beads have a color code. The red and colored beads show her days which she is probably infertile, while the white beads indicate her potential fertile days. The beads are a simple, reusable way for women to track her cycle and show her days that she may be fertile. Again, because of the ease of teaching this method, it's widely taught internationally and is something that can be easily taught in the office setting. Finally, let's talk about fertility awareness-based methods that are actually designed specifically for women who are breastfeeding. The lactational amenorrhea method is the final method I'm going to talk about, and this is a method that may be used in women who are postpartum if they meet the following three criteria. First, the baby must be less than 6 months of age. The woman should be breastfeeding fully or nearly fully, and the woman should not have had a return of menses since the birth of the baby. Of course, breastfeeding in itself provides numerous other benefits, such as maternal child bonding, as well as reducing health problems, cancers, diabetes, and obesity in both the women and the baby. So there's lots of reasons to help promote nursing. In women that meet the three criteria for the lactational amenorrhea method, the effectiveness is very, very high. With correct use and typical use, women experience less than two pregnancies per 100 women years. This is about as effective as the IUD and the depo for both correct and typical use. Again, a very highly effective method. Here's a table with all of the level or one or two studies of fertility awareness-based methods for postponing pregnancy, showing the unintended pregnancy rate with both correct and typical use. I provide this here as a summary, and we'll also make this slide available for John to post on the Med Students for Life website. As you can see, with correct use, the unintended pregnancy rate is less than 5 per 100 women years for all methods and at or below 1 for Billings, Creighton, and Synthothermal methods. So their unintended pregnancy rates stack up well with those of contraceptives. You'll notice that there are no typical use rates associated with the Creighton model. This shows the versatility of fertility awareness-based methods, and that these methods can not only be used to avoid pregnancy, but also to achieve pregnancy. I have listed the total pregnancy rate for the Howard and Stanford study, which is 17%. The challenge with this is it takes into account couples that were not only using this method to avoid pregnancy, but to achieve pregnancy. So if couples became pregnant while trying to achieve, while the way we look at contraceptive effectiveness from a current scientific standpoint, we classify all pregnancies as failures. But couples trying to achieve, I doubt that they would classify such a pregnancy as a failure. Nonetheless, at this point, this is the best data we have. I should note that there is a study undergoing right now, the SEBA study, that will hopefully be published soon, that actually looks at patient intentionality using the Creighton method. That is, they're going to evaluate effectiveness rates, both correct and typical use effectiveness rates, for couples that are actually intending to avoid pregnancy. That data should help us significantly in helping to promote the effectiveness of these methods. Again, as I noted, fertility awareness-based methods are very versatile because they can be used to achieve pregnancy. Most of the methods we've discussed actually can help a couple identify their fertile window. If you can identify the fertile window to avoid pregnancy, then it should also be able to provide enough information to help achieve pregnancy, and that has been found to be true. In couples that are not using any method of natural family planning or fertility awareness-based method in trying to conceive, on average, about 85% will conceive within 1 year. There have been studies of both the Synthothermal and Creighton model that show that the time to conceive is shorter using these methods. For example, with the Synthothermal method, 81% of couples will achieve within 6 months, taking half the time than not using the method at all. Whereas with Creighton, 98% of couples are able to achieve in 6 months. So again, especially with women that may be getting older or that are anxious to become a parent, by being able to reduce the time to conception can be an added benefit of using these methods. But even more so, these methods can be used to help address underlying gynecological problems and, most importantly, are used to treat infertility. The Creighton model in particular is one of those methods because of the link with NAPRO technology, as I mentioned earlier. Thanks to NAPRO, family doctors now have expansive protocols for treating diseases like infertility, and there have been 2 peer-reviewed studies that demonstrate the effectiveness. Again, doctors in these studies were family docs who were trained as Creighton medical consultants and had used NAPRO technology to address infertility in patients struggling with this. This table comes from a paper from one of these studies, and it shows you the power of NAPRO technology to actually diagnose and in often times treat the causes of infertility. If you look at the first column before NAPRO technology evaluation in the red box, you can see that about 58% of the couples had an unexplained reason for their infertility or recurrent miscarriage. So almost 2/3 of the couples did not know why they were not able to carry pregnancy to term. After using NAPRO technology to evaluate these couples, less than 1% were still in the dark as to why they were infertile or having recurrent miscarriages. In the lower level, you can actually see many of the reasons that women were found to be struggling with infertility were able to be diagnosed were due to limited cervical mucus, suboptimal luteal progesterone, and suboptimal luteal estrogen, conditions that are easily treatable by physicians that are trained in NAPRO technology. So let's look at the results. I should note that this patient population was an older patient population, almost 36 years old on average, and had been trying for more than 5 years to conceive. Again, we want to look at patient-oriented evidence that matters. That is, couples that are trying to conceive want a baby. Becoming pregnant is not enough if they have a recurrent miscarriage. In this study, what they were able to discover was that the cumulative proportion of live birth rates was 52.8 per 100 couples. A similar study that was repeated just this past year and published showed similar results. These results demonstrate that there are more affordable options than artificial reproductive technology with comparable live birth rates available in family practice setting. More importantly, these methods of helping couples achieve pregnancy are morally acceptable because, again, it works with the couple and works the woman's body to identify, diagnose, and treat the underlying cause of infertility. So let's discuss, we're going to move on to the final section, and I'm going to go to the end and take any questions then. But let's discuss the advantage of fertility awareness-based methods as a whole, answer some of the criticisms of these methods, and show how you might determine which method might be best for the patient that you're seeing. So what are the advantages of fertility awareness-based methods? As I've discussed, they are both safe and effective. They do not involve artificial hormones, which can have numerous side effects over time, such as increasing a woman's risk for breast and cervical cancer. If you're not aware, the combination oral contraceptive pill is classified as a Group 1 carcinogen by the World Health Organization, placing it in the same category as tobacco or asbestos because of the increased risk of breast and cervical cancer, not to mention the increased risk of blood clots and other cardiovascular complications, whereas natural methods do not have any of these harmful medical side effects. And again, these natural methods are comparable with artificial contraceptives in terms of effectiveness. Second, these methods teach women how to understand their cycle and to recognize what is healthy and what is normal so that they know when to seek health care. Third, users of these methods learn self-control and family planning, just as they might learn with diet or with exercise. They learn to understand and make decisions responsibly. Fourth, these methods can also empower couples with knowledge about their fertility. When a couple can understand and appreciate it, it's better than actually destroying or attempting to eliminate their fertility. Again, as I noted, fertility awareness-based methods have actually been shown to improve relationships and communication. As you can imagine, it's important for a couple to communicate, for a woman to communicate to her partner that she may be entering her fertile period, and to have a conversation as to whether or not they are interested in trying to conceive or trying to avoid. By having this conversation on a monthly basis, it makes it much easier to talk about a whole host of other things. Again, there are minimal costs associated with these methods. Most costs occur up front for the training it takes to learn these methods, with only small costs associated with future use, for instance, for charting. More importantly, these methods can be used at every stage of a woman's life. Young girls can teach this, can learn this as adolescents to have a better understanding of their fertility and of their cycles. And women approaching menopause can use this again because there's no harmful side effects associated with it. And finally, many patients believe that it's wrong to disrupt fertility, a normal physiological process, simply for the sake of sexual pleasure. Natural family planning or fertility awareness-based methods of family planning respect the natural times of fertility and infertility. This is also appealing for patients that are concerned about the environment, as these are ecologically friendly and have no harmful effects for the environment. Now let me talk briefly about some of the criticisms of natural methods of family planning. What I've listed here are the actual disadvantages that are listed in the book, A Pocket Guide to Managing Contraception. This is a book that most medical students and residents carry around when they're on the medical floors. And if you look up the disadvantages of using natural methods, these are those listed. First, irregular absence cycles. It's thought that these methods may not be able to be used during these cycles. But as I showed, many of these methods do not require women to have regular cycles to be able to use. And while abnormal discharge or irregular cycles may make these a little bit more difficult to use, these methods can also help patients recognize abnormalities and seek treatment. Thus, they might avoid unnecessary tests and treatments since they know the range of their normal cervical mucus. Another criticism is that fertility awareness-based methods do not prevent or protect against STDs, but neither do other contraceptives over a lifetime of use. And actually, women who use oral contraceptives appear to be at increased risk of chlamydia than those women not using contraception. Women using Depo-Provera, an injectable form of contraception, have been found to have a higher risk of HIV, even after controlling for condom usage. Another criticism is that abstinence is required for a short period of time during the woman's fertile cycle if a couple is trying to avoid pregnancy. But no contraceptive is 100% effective, so if a couple really, really must avoid pregnancy, they should be abstaining anyway during the fertile period. Further, abstinence gets a bad rap, thought that it's a bad thing that we should have to abstain from anything pleasurable. But abstinence is not necessarily bad. With self-control, people can abstain from alcohol, indulgent food, sexual activity, etc. Currently, I'm sure we're all abstaining from pleasurable activities as we're sitting listening to this webcast, and it's something that we're all able to do. These methods are also labeled as unforgiving. We've already showed you how effective these modern methods are. Part of why they're labeled as unforgiving is based on an effectiveness rate that's commonly quoted and was actually quoted in the AFP article I mentioned earlier. These methods are often quoted as being 76% effective with typical use effectiveness. Now, clearly, the 76% number differs drastically from the numbers that I quoted you, so let me tell you where that number comes from. The 76% typical effectiveness rate is a number that's derived from a survey of women through the National Survey for Family and Growth. And essentially what researchers did is call women on the phone, and if they had conceived, ask them to recall what method they were using at the time that they conceived. They then adjusted this number based on an assumption that there might be an underreporting of abortion, again, falsely elevating this number. And what the researchers who actually did this research said themselves was that many of the women who reported using a natural method, in fact, over 80% of the women who reported using a natural method reported using the older rhythm method. But they lumped all of these methods in one statistic. This is very misleading. It would be as if we said the progesterone IUD is as effective as the progesterone mini pill because they're all progesterone and we lump them together. We don't do that. It's important to look at each method individually to see how effective it is. This last criticism, I think, is probably my favorite. They say one of the disadvantages of these methods require discipline, communication, and a commitment between the partners. And I ask you, what's so wrong about that? Shouldn't we want our good communication between sexual partners and a commitment between sexual partners? I certainly don't see that as a disadvantage. While it is required, I do not think that in and of itself is a disadvantage. So is there a best method? We've talked about many, and hopefully you've seen how diverse these methods can be. Let me talk very, very briefly, because I know we're near the end of our time, about how to decide which method to use. The best method, I believe, is the method that works best for the couple. I do not believe that there is one best method. Proponents of individual methods will push their method as the best, but really it depends on the couple's needs and the characteristics of the different methods, and it's up to you to help patients decide. So how can you choose, or how can you help a couple choose? Well, think about some of the aspects of the method and the aspects, characteristics of the patients. So for patients with limited time or health literacy, the two-day method and the standard days method and the billing methods are all very effective. There's a further simplified version of the Billings method known as the Family of the Americas method. It is essentially the Billings method, but the teaching materials are very pictorial-based and simplified. It's actually the method that we use in my community health center where we serve an almost exclusively non-English-speaking illiterate patient population, and it's been very effective with those people. In couples with irregular cycles, Billings, Creighton, Symptothermal, and Marquette can all be used effectively. If couples are interested in doing online charting, Billings, Symptothermal, and Marquette all could be used online. I would caution you, there are lots and lots of apps out there for couples to chart online. A lot of them actually use the old calendar rhythm method for helping couples determine their fertile period, so I would encourage you to refer patients to the websites of Marquette, Couple to Couple, or Billings directly to use their charting tools. I'm going to move along. But as you can see, these methods, there's a diversity of methods that you can offer patients depending on their needs. As we come to a conclusion, I want to ask you to consider what your role is in terms of encouraging the use of fertility awareness-based methods of family planning. First, I hope that I've given you enough information to show that these methods are a valid option for family planning. And I would encourage you to identify teachers in your area to be able to refer patients to. I would also encourage you to learn more about these methods yourself. Consider becoming a teacher of one of these methods or working with them. Third, I hope that you might consider joining FACTS as we work to educate medical students, residents, and family physicians about these methods. As you can see from this picture, we're a very diverse group, male and female, of all ages and of all walks of life, both medical and non-medical. What we do share is a common goal to promote educating people about these so that we can really truly offer women the full range of options. I hope that you've learned a lot today. Again, this was a presentation that we developed as part of the FACTS Collaborative, a group that we founded in 2010. If you're interested in joining us, I would encourage you to go to our website at www.fmec.net/fertility. Thank you very much. If you have further questions, I'm happy to address them now, or I can be reached via email. Thank you.
Hey, I am going to throw out just a couple questions. We did have several questions on the Family of America's method and your opinion. You did share that a little bit here towards the end. Let me get to two questions, and then I will email you, Dr. Duane, all 12 of these questions so you could communicate with them directly.
Sure, and I'll just comment on the Family of America's method. Again, it's based on the Billings method. The reason we do not include it in the presentation is there are no actual scientific studies of that method itself, but because it is based on the Billings method, I believe it is as effective. Again, I think the real difference is in the simplicity of the teaching tools. And what you want to ask yourself is, you know, what do you need to be able to effectively educate and communicate this information to the patients that you're teaching? I like the Family of the Americas method very, very much because I think it is very easy to help communicate this information to patients. And it's very intuitive for them because how they teach it is by comparing the fertility of a woman's cycle to the fertility of the land, which it makes it very easy for patients to understand, both men and women, I should say.
Okay. The first question I have for you here is from Kathy in Fort Mill. She asks, when a patient stops using oral birth control, how long does it take for her body to return to a normal and what side effects are common during this transition?
That's a great question, Kathy, and really it depends. It depends on the woman and the type of contraceptive she's been using and how long she's been using it for. Some women can actually revert back to a normal cycle pretty quickly, and we certainly recommend if a woman is stopping an oral contraceptive to learn one of these methods sooner rather than later. Many of these methods, Billings, Creighton, SimpliThermal, all have specific instructions for use in women that are coming off of hormonal contraceptives because it can cause changes that may cause a little bit of confusion in the beginning. Typically, with a lot of the methods, what they'll do is in the first month of use, they'll actually encourage a couple to abstain for the full month, in part because it's important for a woman to be able to identify her mucus. And if you add semen into the equation, it can be confusing for women in that first month. With the hormonal contraceptives, some women, as I said, will revert back to a normal cycle within 1 month. Some women it will take a longer period of time. But all of these methods can be taught. Some of these methods can be taught and used effectively by women as soon as they go off hormonal contraceptives. But that would be something to be sure to note for a woman to note when she is talking with her healthcare provider.
Great. The next last final question is from Lewis in York. Lewis asks, in any of these methods, how does the woman in interpret secretions that may be related to bacterial
vaginosis.
Yes, thank you. Yeast or other infections.
That's again also a great question. Once women are able to learn to identify their mucus, they can tell what's normal and what's not. And again, that's one of the advantages of these methods. By teaching women to observe what their mucus pattern, they can begin to identify something that is abnormal. With bacterial vaginosis, the mucus is going to be different. It's not going to have that clear, white, stretchy appearance. It will sometimes be yellow in color. It may be a little bit more clumpy, but it will appear distinctly different from normal fertile cervical mucus. And as a perfect case in point, I had a patient that came in literally month after month convinced that she had bacterial vaginosis because she had this discharge. And month after month, I did the exam, and I looked at it, and I kept telling her, I'm like, no, this is your fertile cervical mucus. She had never learned that she produced this mucus, and she naturally assumed, because our society has really, you know, driven this message home that if you have a vaginal discharge, you must have a vaginal infection. We've equated vaginal cervical mucus or vaginal discharge with infection, when in fact it very well may be a woman's normal cervical discharge. Lewis, I can't tell you that, you know, if it's yellow and thick and et cetera, it's this versus that. But what I can tell you is when a woman observes her cycle, she will begin to observe the pattern of her mucus and will be able to tell, this just doesn't look right. She may not be able to tell, oh, this is BV, but she could say, like, this is different from what I normally have. And again, with using these methods, what it can do is it can often bring these women to the attention of a medical care provider sooner rather than later, because she can identify in an earlier stage that this just isn't a normal mucus discharge. One other point I did mention, there are some women that do struggle with chronic discharge or a baseline discharge, and women who have that can still use some of these methods. And what they're taught is this is what their baseline pattern is. And so once you're able to identify what is normal for that woman, she can then observe the changes. And that's really key, I think, with a lot of these cervical mucus methods, is being to identify the change from the fertile type mucus to the infertile type mucus. So you can't say it's one specific description, but it's important for a woman to be able to identify what's normal for her to then be able to say, this is different from what's normal for me.
Okay. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure, absolutely.
Great. Let's see here.
And I appreciate people staying on.
Yeah, people are staying on, and we're getting a lot of questions. the other question I have for you is, one is, I guess this is a question for a lot of the medical students. Dave in Cincinnati asked, are these methods being taught in medical schools?
That's a great question, David. And I would say not to any great degree. Interestingly, the science behind these methods is not new. I mean, this is basic reproductive physiology. So in a sense, that information is being taught, but it's often a very brief lecture. And what isn't happening is most, I can't say most because I haven't been to every medical school, but I would be surprised if most medical schools actually tie the physiology piece to then using this as a method of family planning. Part of the motivation behind founding the FACTS group was this recognition that these methods are not being taught. We just conducted a survey of residency programs in the Northeast, family medicine residency programs, and we surveyed the faculty who were responsible for the women's health curriculum within the family medicine residency program. So these are the people that are teaching about family planning to future physicians, or current residents, future physicians. Of the faculty that we surveyed, most were not familiar with any of these modern methods. So if the faculty aren't aware of them, how are they going to be able to teach the residents and the medical students? For those that were familiar with methods, most of them were familiar with the outdated rhythm method. And that's surprising. I mean, science changes and advances over time. You know, in the 1920s, we treated tuberculosis by putting patients in an iron lung. We don't treat tuberculosis like that anymore because science has advanced, medicines have advanced. So why then, if we're going to talk about natural family planning or fertility awareness-based methods, why are we allowing physicians to teach or to identify rhythm as the only method that's being taught? You know, science has advanced. Unfortunately, medical education, residency education has not caught up. I gave a similar talk to a residency program about a year ago, and one of the participants asked me the question, well, why not? Why aren't we learning about these methods? And I said to her, you know, I can't say for sure why we're not, but one of the reasons I suspect is that much of our medical education, especially once we get out of medical school, is driven by pharmaceutical companies. And pharmaceutical companies do not gain anything by having couples learn about natural methods. If anything, they stand to lose a lot of money if more and more women and couples use these methods for family planning. And so I think that's part of it. But I think part of it is that, you know, the faculty in medical schools and residencies weren't taught this, and so if they didn't learn it, how can they teach to others? And that's where FACTS comes in. The FACTS group really is committed to teaching people about these methods because we want women to have the full range of options. We want them to realize that these are out there. They may not be for everyone, but there are a lot of women that would be interested in using these methods that are not even given the opportunity because their doctors are not familiar with it because the medical school and residency faculty did not teach them.
Okay. just want to let everyone know, if you are a medical student, Dr. Duane will be traveling with us on a limited basis for our spring med tour coming up, starting at the end of February and going through April. She'll be one of many doctors joining us. And so if your med group is interested in hosting Dr. Duane to come and do a lunchtime lecture at your school, please to be sure to get with us at Medical Students for Life. Dr. Duane, thank you for being with us. And this broadcast will be available on our website. And some of the questions that were asked here, or there's some more complex questions. I am going to pass everybody who submitted questions tonight, I'm going to be passing it on to Dr. Duane so she can work on getting back to you. So anyway, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us tonight, and look forward to hearing great things about what you've learned and getting involved in this movement. So thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone. I really appreciated it, and I will do my best to respond to your questions within the next week, so please feel free to forward them along. Thank you.
The moderator has left the conference.